Unbearable stress or a traumatic event may trigger the condition experienced by about 2 out of every 1,000 people in the United States, and commonly referred to as dissociative fugue. When in dissociative fugue, people disappear from their usual routines and may assume new identities, forgetting all or some of their usual lives. Fugues last hours, days, but with an extra kick have been known to last the entire lifespan of a particularly troubled human individual. There has been some speculation over whether the creator of this program is suffering from dissociative fugue, assuming one or several identities for the purposes of protracted cultural conversation. We shall let these speculations continue, for the creator of this program is neither important nor particularly well endowed. Assuming, of course, that you believe the veracity of this introduction, in which case, perhaps, you are the one suffering from dissociative fugue, and not the creator.
Okay, so I'm here with Brian Evanson, who is most recently the author of Fugue Steak, Last Days, Aliens No Exit, and a number of other books. Brian, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, very good.
I wanted to start off with a general question that maybe not that may not actually be a general question, but nevertheless, it's a good place to start. I want to talk about when you come up with a concept for a story or a book, I'm wondering how you know it's going to have legs. Because often your concepts will work on multiple levels.
Right.
You'll have some sort of psychological inversion that actually works against the concept.
Right.
I think, for example, of A Pursuit, where you have a guy who's on the road being pursued by his ex-wives, and then it turns out to be all about what's inside his head.
Right.
I think about In the Greenhouse, which, aside from the postmodern angle, likewise has that scenario going on,
right,
where it's
right.
not really about the concept of the desk in the greenhouse, etc.
Right.
So do you know in advance? Do you think these things out in advance in terms of like...
No, I don't. I mean, I think it varies from piece to piece, but I think there's a lot of ideas that I try out that just never come to anything.
Uh-huh.
And so it's just, you know, what you're getting, I guess, are the greatest hits, the ideas that actually do work and that take off.
Oh, yeah.
But it is fairly intuitive. It's kind of random in some ways. It's I'll start with something, and then, like with A Pursuit, it started to surprise me how it went.
Yeah.
And then at a certain point in the middle of the story, I kind of knew it was going, but it took a while.
How many false starts do you generally have, out of curiosity, before you know it's the right concept?
I can have two or three before I get to the right concept.
Really?
Yeah.
So it's a matter of, I guess, keeping things spontaneous and being constantly surprised to know the concept is working?
Well, I think it's that if I start writing a story and I know where it's going to go, I get bored, and I'm not interested in it, and it ends up feeling wooden and you know, not very interesting.
Huh.
And so it's only when I'm writing and I think I get to a certain point and there's a swerve or there's a transformation of some kind that I'm not expecting. Even though I do admit that a lot of my stories all seem to tend towards death. but I do think that they still surprise me how the way in which they go about doing that.
This just leads me to ask you about when you need that transformation before you get bored. I mean, can you write in a sort of, I suppose, quote, pedestrian concept for about a couple of pages, and then you need something to happen, like, say, two pages or two paragraphs or two sentences?
I think it's just when the idea starts to feel like it's used up in some ways, when I can't move it around and see a new facet of it.
Yeah.
And so it really depends on how complicated the idea is.
Yeah.
But, you know, something like my novel, The Open Curtain, it took me probably 5 years to figure out how to end that and how to go through the last section of that.
Huh.
And I kept on trying different things, and it wasn't working, but there was something about the idea as a whole that still had its claws in me.
Yeah.
So, but other things, I've gotten that far, written 100 or 200 pages, and just let them go. And I may go back to them someday, but I just, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does the surprise often happen in revision at all, or does it have to happen at the moment of concocting a narrative?
It doesn't have to happen at the moment of concocting it, but I do tend to get a structure in place during that first writing of the story, and only rarely does that actually change. That actually, The Open Curtain is one example of when it did change. I had a very specific idea of how the second half of the book should work, and it was totally wrong. And so it took me, you know, a few years to decide I had to let that go, and then a few years for something else to come up. So but most of the time I try to get a kind of structure in place, basic structure of the story, basic kind of arc of the story. And things can change, individual things can change, and yeah, things get more complicated and other things simplify themselves out, but it's basically there.
Do you think that you're more often right than you are wrong? Does another story or another novel offer you an opportunity to rework a particular concept that didn't work before in a previous story, or maybe a half-explored idea?
Well, I think a lot of my stories especially are taking up things in other stories of mine or people that I've read, mm-hmm, and starting to go in different directions. So that story of Pursuit that you were talking about is playing with... there's a novel by Anne Quinn, which is called Triptychs, which I really like, but which there's a certain moment where she could have taken it one direction, and she didn't. And I just, reading that, I kept thinking again and again about this other direction, and that ended up being the thing that generated the story.
Huh.
And then, you know, I think in Fugue State, there's several stories about these, what I call my girls in trouble stories.
Yes.
And I think that with those too, it was I had an idea or a concept that I kept on kind of moving around or shifting or trying to get to go in a different direction. And probably still have a few more of those to do because I don't feel like I've quite exhausted that in the way that I want to yet. Yeah.
Do you need to have a source text more than, I suppose, a personal experience? I mean, I can inquire as to whether you actually had sex with a mime. I don't know if you have or not.
No, I haven't. I did meet someone after I read that story aloud who had had sex with a mime.
Yeah.
And it made me think that maybe I could have gone even farther in that story than I did. But not a lot of it is personal experience. I mean, I think the things that are from personal experience are not the things that you would expect. Mm-hmm. So in some of those younger and girls in tents, you know, when I was a kid, I used to make tents out of blankets, which I think a lot of kids did. But
I did myself. Yeah.
But my daughters never did. So it was, you know, there is a kind of personal thing there. There's a moment in one of my stories, I think actually it's in The Wavering Knife, in that collection, in which someone is taking bread and kind of squishing it until it makes a kind of ball of bread. And, you know, that's something that's incredibly vivid to me from my childhood.
Yeah.
But you know, the main thrusts of the plot and those sorts of things are not personal experience so much. But they do respond to a lot of other things.
But then you're also dealing with a lot of mutilation and violence, like in particular in Last Days.
Right.
I mean, clearly I see that you are probably a zero according to that particular scale.
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
Unless
I'm a zero.
There's something you're not showing me. I don't know.
No, no, that's
but,
right.
But I mean, you know, how do you get into that particular mindset to make a narrative along those lines real when you have not personally experienced? I mean, there's the old famous story of like, well, Stephen Crane never experienced or ever witnessed any kind of war. So how does reality come about for you? When do you know that it's real if you haven't experienced it? Or, I mean, are we underestimating verisimilitude and not always capitulating to that wonderful imagination?
Well, I do think it's... I really do think a lot about how things would feel, even if I haven't experienced them. I really see myself as partly a... I don't know quite how to describe it, but I want to create a world that the reader experiences as if they're living through it more than something that they can see as a representation on the page. And to do that, I spend a lot of time thinking about how things would feel, how things would occur, what would happen to a limb if you did something to it in Last Days. And I think it's, you know, I read a fair amount and try to figure out things that way, but mostly I think it's just trying, I think it's what you say, the primacy of the imagination and trying to imagine yourself into a space where you really are experiencing something on the page in a very visceral way. And so I think the stories, I mean, one of the things that people say about my stories, both for better or for worse, is that there's stories that you don't forget and there's stories that you feel like you're, you know, you feel like you're kind of suffering through them in some ways while as the character suffers.
Yeah.
And you know, as a writer, I think that's very much what I do. I try to put myself very very much in a position of the characters in the story. So there's all these, in Last Days, there's all these moments in the hospital bed.
Yeah.
And trying to figure out, all right, how do you see around the curtain if you have a one kind of mirror and another kind of mirror? How do you, you know, if you can't move this part of your body, then what do you do?
Yeah.
And it really just, I took a lot of time just thinking very seriously about that, you know, trying to figure out, all right, what would I do?
But I'm not sure if it's always tangible like this. Like, the creepiest scene for me in Last Days was the stripping scene.
Right.
Where it's both utterly creepy, but at the same time, it's also utterly absurd.
Right.
So you're having this wonderful experience. I mean, well, wonderful is probably not the right modifier, but you're having this experience that's quite interesting.
Right, right.
In which you are having two simultaneous emotions at one time.
Right.
So I'm curious as to how something along those lines, these constant opposing emotions at the same time come into being. Is it largely probably through accident along the lines of this conceptualization? I mean, there's probably, I would figure maybe that strip scene was possibly like maybe a sixth attempt after all these ideas.
That actually, weirdly enough, came right away.
Oh.
which maybe says something about me. I don't know. With something like that, I mean, I think it is that there is this, you know, a lot of my work, I think, tries to have language that's really careful and precise and that draws the reader in and that has a kind of rhythm to it. And then the content is often horrific. The content is something that it's hard to put together with the kind of smoothness of the language or the, you know, the kind of constancy of the language. And so I think that creates a kind of emotional tension, that you're experiencing something on one level, which is very mellifluous, that's very flowing. And then on the other hand, you know, in that scene with the stripper, for instance, I mean, you're seeing something that's absurd, that's really just way, you know, out of left field. It's not what you expect is going to happen at all.
Yeah.
So it's those tensions that I really love. And then I think humor and violence is another big tension in my work.
Yeah.
I think that, and in Last Days, that comes out a lot. I think that there are moments where it's so absurd that it becomes funny.
Yeah.
And then there are other moments where what's funny starts to dry up or become very disturbing.
It's quite interesting because I'm curious as to what degree the amount of detail you have in terms of describing how limbs and various other appendages are mutilated plays into this tension between humor and violence.
Because
sometimes you're general about it and you leave it to the reader's imagination.
Right.
Other times you're a little bit more specific and therefore it becomes more horrific. Did you calibrate this similar to the scale that was actually within the story, within the actual novel?
Well, yeah, I mean, I did think about it a lot. There were, when I wrote Last Days, there were moments that were more specific that I cut back and that became more general. And partly because it, as you say, it does create a different effect. It's not as kind of horrific on the surface, but it does let things start to happen in your head in a way that just reading a description of something that's very specific doesn't. So I think there's that on the one hand. And then on the other hand, there were moments that were less specific that I just felt needed to be filled out as I started to investigate them more.
Yeah.
So it is. It's for me. I do feel like I'm kind of this guy with a calibrator who goes through that's probably a lot of my revision process is me going through different parts of the work and toning, you know, dialing things up and dialing things down and trying to get the balance right and figuring out, all right, the rhythm here goes a certain way. How does that fit in with what's going on with the action itself? How does it help create an effect or not help create an effect?
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
This makes me wonder if you have a whole legion of guinea pigs with which to test your calibrations or whether you this is largely kind of you're a mad scientist and you want to see how people react after the fact.
Well, I think it's more a mad scientist. I mean, I actually don't show my work to anybody before I send it off to either an editor or my agent, depending on what I'm doing. And I used to. I used to have people I'd show my work to. And I don't know why that's the case, but for some reason I felt that I began to feel that I worked much better if I was working almost inside of a box or something.
Yeah.
And it is, it's true. I don't know when the work goes out. I mean, I have some ideas from the work that's gone out before what effect it's going to have. But there are always things that really surprise me about the response to the work.
Is this your way of defying audience expectations or audience response and keeping the mad world, I mean,
maybe you can't always calibrate how it's going to be perceived, and so as a result, people are going to interpret something along these lines
right.
and run with it with their own particular impressions. Are you concerned about such responses? I mean,
well, I guess I should be. I mean, my first book, you probably know, had a very negative response
yes.
to it because, and that response was a complete surprise to me.
Yeah,
I mean, I really didn't foresee it at all. Mormons objected to it very strongly, mm-hmm. But I don't know. I like that, too. I like feeling like, you know, that what I'm working on is something that... I mean, I really do think of it as a kind of world in and of itself that I'm creating. Mm-hmm. And that if I start to bring in too many things from the outside world, I worry that it changes just the nature of the world itself or lets it be less of a world in some ways.
Yeah.
And so I would rather take the risk of having it be disastrous and just let it develop in its own terms, kind of within that terrarium or box or whatever it is.
Yeah. So, I mean, to tie this large world, I should bring up Bjorn Verenson, I understand by reading some various papers and being on a few mailing lists that he was involved in Stieg Larsson's death. Maybe you could explain this.
Yeah, Bjorn Verenson is a pseudonym I've used a couple of times, not very often, and there's a kind of mythology that I've played around with and built up about him. But he also appears as a character, as a pseudonym within one of my stories, as well as, you know, in one of the stories in Fugue State, he comes up. Yeah.
Well, actually, I wanted to ask, one of the characters bears certain mnemonic resemblances to Morgan Entrekin, and I'm curious if that was a specific intention on your part. Or can you actually say anything about that?
Well, that story, which suddenly I've forgotten the name of my own story, but 90 over 90. That story, you know, it's a very direct response to the world of publishing, and there are certain names that I think resemble names in publishing. Morgan Entrekin, I don't think, is to be singled out so much as there are a few others that might be singled out even more.
Oh, okay.
But sure. I mean, I think that it was something that was written just thinking about the world of publishing and how it was changing and the complications and you know, what things like trying to market books for people who only read one book a year has done to the publishing industry.
Yeah.
But it ends up being a different sort of story about different kinds of fears, I guess, as well.
Yeah. This is kind of an elementary question, but I think I want to ask it anyway because your stories do leave a lot in the way of interpretation.
Uh-huh.
That is, knowing the exact time when you must end a story. I think of like the last line of Helpful,
uh-huh.
where you leave the reader with all sorts of possibilities. Well, how is this guy going to continue to live?
Right.
How is that going to resolve itself,
right.
Versus resolving something to a point where it's relatively closed.
Right.
And I'm curious as to how such decisions come about. Do they work in relation to this larger dilemma that we were just talking about earlier about exploring a concept and running with it to the point where, you know, it gets inverted psychologically, and this determines whether an ending is closed or open? Maybe you can talk about that.
Well, I think I tend much more towards the open ending than I do the closed ending. And I think part of that is just that it probably has to do with I was trained as a theorist in graduate school. I did my PhD in critical theory, and I think the way I think about the world is that it's a very kind of open-ended thing, and it's hard to pin everything down. And so I think that the fiction does kind of reproduce that. The story you're talking about, Helpful, was an example of a story that did surprise me, where I actually had an idea that it was going to go on from there, and then I wrote that last sentence, and that seemed to me like it balanced. That was, so for me, that story's in two halves. One half is that sentence, and the other half is all the rest of the story.
Yeah.
And they balance against each other. And so for me, that was a moment when I thought it was going to go somewhere else and keep on developing, but that was enough. It just came to that.
Similarly, I want to ask you about some of the shorter stories, such as Invisible Box, which we mentioned earlier.
Uh-huh.
With the shorter stories, I have found that you work more of the fantastical and conceptual elements more than the psychological fiction and all that, the psychological horror.
Right,
and I'm curious if these shorter stories offer you an opportunity with which to constrain yourself and to see if you can work within such limitations, or how do these short stories, these short shorts, or
well,
not flash fiction, but certainly... certainly.
They do let me try out different things, I think, and you know, not all the short shorts I do. I don't publish all of them. I publish some and not others. And there are things. I mean, I think you start to see certain aspects of the stories appear in the novels, and are building blocks for the novels. But at the same time, I mean, they really do conceptually those short pieces. I can explore a concept in a very precise way, in a way that you just can't in a novel. Someone who's reading a novel just doesn't have the level of attention that allows you to be incredibly, incredibly precise with a concept. And you know, you would get lost and bored if that was all that was going on in a novel. Well, and in a story, you can do it.
And this leads me to also ask about An Accounting and Last Days, which share a lot of similarities in terms of brotherhood and violence and the like. I mean, brotherhoods are throughout your work, but I'm curious, of those two, which one came first, and did one lead you to explore certain aspects in another that you were able to, I guess, try again or whatnot?
With that one, Last Days kind of came first, because it was the first part of Last Days was published as a kind of limited edition novella before the novel came out. And then I think Accounting probably came while I was finishing the second part of Last Days. I'd have to think about it. But then a later story, the last book in that, last story in Fugue State, The Adjudicator, is kind of an attempt to go back to some aspects of the Accounting and rethink them and rework them. So there is a conversation going on between these stories. And
I'm glad you brought up The Adjudicator, because I wanted to ask you about both The Adjudicator and The Third Factor, where you have these characters clinging to this bureaucratese sort of language throughout, and it's rather funny and disturbing how they cling to this almost like a cult. I'm curious as to how this particular concern came about, and how language itself allows a particular concept to flow in the surprising way that you were talking about earlier.
Well, I think a lot of my stories are interested in thinking about community and thinking about very complicated notions of community. And that probably started with my investigation of weird religious communities, which, you know, partly comes from me coming out of a weird religious community myself. But I think it's more than that. I mean, I think that it's pretty fascinating when you start looking at religious communities and how they operate and how the power structures are set up and the way in which those kind of inform interpersonal relations. But then also that stuff, I think, extrapolates to other kinds of communities and bureaucracy. And you know, Mormonism is probably the most bureaucratic religion in the world. It's very, very structured, and it's very much run like a bureaucracy. And so I think there is a kind of extension of that allowed me to think about those other things.
I just thinking about also how in A Pursuit and Wander, you often have mysterious figures pursue solitary men, which I find extremely interesting in light of what you just said about community. It's also about how community is going to come and essentially wrap its wings around the individual.
There is something kind of rapacious about it. True. There is a real tension between being an individual and being part of a community, and both in The Adjudicator and in a number of the stories in that book. I mean, there is this thing where you have this kind of bureaucracy that the people are both grudgingly a part of and kind of object to, but they can't quite get themselves outside of it. Or The Accounting, where it's someone who's been completely outside of it, and he's coming back into it and now trying to justify himself in the terms of... And kind of trying to justify himself, but also maybe, you know, it's hard to know how much of what he's saying is something he believes and something he's doing just to save himself.
This is kind of related to a topic. Now, here's a large question, so bear with me here.
Okay.
There's an interesting essay on Fugue State in The Collages by Ryan Call.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure you saw that.
I did,
He noted the opening sentence to Fugue State, basically, I had Bentham Klain fall into a sort of fugue state. He described that he had a click in his brain where he suddenly realized, oh, well, he didn't entirely understand fugue state. This is not necessarily just a literalism. There's probably more going on. Simultaneously, I noticed a similar moment in Last Days where you have a character basically shout, "We found you, Mr. Klain," which I thought to myself, well, wait a minute, we already know this. We don't need him to shout that. This is quite melodramatic. Until I realized, well, he used we, and it goes back to the whole, like, we're going to get you motif that goes throughout that whole scenario. There are more of these literalisms, I think, cropping up in your work lately than I've seen in some of your earlier work, and I'm curious about this.
is it really a literalism? Is it a, is the idea here to suggest that like what we see, what is that is apparently blatant and rudimentary, is not so blatant and rudimentary, right, that there is something else going on, that we're essentially discounting this?
Right.
What of this particular language impulse here?
Hopefully, a lot of those moments are things that you catch on that you start to think. Well, you know, initially they maybe seem banal, or they may seem like it doesn't need to be stated, but they start to get you thinking and start to get you, you know, wondering about things. And I guess the other impulse is the thing that happens in things like Younger, where things are stated and then they're taken away, that they get more and more dubious as, you know, you get to a point where it's very hard to understand what anything means or what anything is.
Yeah.
And so on the one hand, you have something that seems very literal, but that maybe starts to point to these subterranean meetings. And on the other hand, you have something that is very plainly stated and then taken back and you know, contradicted and kind of taken away.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know. It's part of a larger interest for me in two things. One being what it means to know something, whether it's really possible to know anything or not. I mean, our ability to know is kind of a weird ability or a dubious ability, and it's very, very provisional. And then the other, I think, with the thing you're talking about with "We found you, Mr. Klein," is there are these gestures that are playing with genre as well, that I'm very deliberately playing with the detective story, and what you're talking about with that particular scene where this notion of pursuit that's being almost overemphasized, and it's almost at moments like these people are reading from a script, that they see that they're playing a role or something like that. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, there's also the notion of what human means. I don't want to give the end of Last Days away, but it is rather interesting that this character and other characters insists that the character in question is not human.
Right.
And it challenges our assumption about what that particular word human really means.
Right.
And
right.
So maybe what I sense that you're moving towards is the idea of going to one word and saying, no, it could be anything. And is this so one of the motivations of your fiction, would you say?
Well, I do think I do like the fiction that, as a reader, I like fiction that destabilizes things for me. I mean, I do like to read stories that, when I'm done with them, I feel like I know the world almost less than I did when I began with. There's something I find really exhilarating about that. And I think as a writer, I probably do like to do that as well to some degree. But, you know, at the same time, I mean, I do think that something like Last Days is trying to say something very particular about certain issues in regard to religion and community and being human, as you say. And even though there's a tentativeness to that, I think there are some thematic things that are pretty definite at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious what...
I feel like I'm being a little evasive.
Oh,
but I guess that makes sense.
No, it sort of does, because it leads us to look and peer into your answers and find additional motivations. Which,
well, hopefully there'll be something there.
Something like that. But I mean, it leads me to also ask you about how translation has affected this, I guess, pursuit of manifold meanings within the course of the story or narrative.
Well, I think that translation's been very important to me as a writer, partly because it's a really good way of kind of getting inside of someone else's style and seeing how they think about the world, how they kind of put a narrative together. And so I think I've learned a lot from translating writers. I mainly translate from French. I've done some Spanish before, but mainly French is what I do. Mm-hmm. And there are, I mean, I can think of a couple of writers I've translated that are just really important to me. One is Antoine Volodine, who does things that I wish I did, and I really love that. These moments when you find a writer that does things that you're jealous of, and that you feel like you can learn from.
Oh yeah. Well, okay. I also wanted to respond to have you respond to Carl's essay. He suggested that you had the DSM-4 at your side. I didn't quite get an answer to another question I had suggested that text is a responsive way, or rather, your fiction is a responsive form, or a way of responding to text or other books that you have. And I'm curious to what degree you still do this. You mentioned earlier that you're kind of moving more towards pulp and playing with pulp formulations.
Right.
But I'm curious, is theory becoming something you're less interested in and you're more interested in, I suppose, synthesizing what genres other people tend to sort of frown on or thumb their noses at and that kind of thing, this is more your emphasis now, would you say? Is theory still there? Yeah, moving.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, well, I do respond very directly to a lot of different texts, and that is a big part of it for me. I mean, I read a lot of philosophy and theory, but I really read it as if it's fiction, and so I don't think I never set out to like prove something that Foucault's doing or Deleuze is doing or you know whoever. But I do think that there's aspects of their thinking that of Deleuze's thinking especially that has an effect on how I think about how narrative comes together and how you know what's going on with that. But in addition to that, yeah, I do respond very directly sometimes to works that I'm reading and books that I'm reading or other stories of mine. I do feel like I'm part of a larger conversation about literature. And I read a lot. I really see reading as totally essential to me as a writer.
Yeah.
And that can really vary. I mean, for years I was obsessed with this story by William Trevor called Miss Smith, and I don't think a day went by for about 6 months where I didn't think about something that story did. And then I, you know, tried to sort it out. Or it can be someone like Isaac Dinesen. It can also be someone, you know, like Roberto Bolaño or just anything. I have a story that kind of picks up on a line that's 400 pages into The Savage Detectives.
Yeah.
And it's just something that's mentioned in passing and that started something for me.
Yeah.
So I do think that for me a lot of the ideas do initial concepts do seem to come from just glimpses or glimmers I see in someone else's work. So
does this also motivate some of the language within the stories? Like, for example, in an accounting, there's the whole reader, we ate him, which, again, works on this notion of being absurd but also strange,
right.
In the sense that here is this rather formalistic way of speaking applied to the most preposterous situation.
Right.
And so
right.
on a sentence level, how do you pursue this?
Well, that's a very particular story in that it's a somewhat futuristic story that seems to have an almost 18th century diction to it. Mm-hmm. And there was a kind of logic to that. I mean, I think that what I was trying to do was capture something about kind of travel narratives and explore narratives from that time, but at the same time really get to something very, very different. And the formality of it, I think, is a formality that ties into that character and his both declaiming the Bible, saying that he's not involved in this, disclaiming, not declaiming, but saying he's not involved with it. And then also having entered into this phase where he's seen as a religious figure by other people. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think I probably skipped another part of your question when I was answering that.
I think we were trying to talk about the role other textual sentences or we got into it a little bit in the last answer,
right.
But we're talking, I mean, like, for example, in Altus Kuldjus,
uh-huh.
You know, the Marie Celeste, clearly, that's based on. But on the other hand,
yeah.
If it's all inside his head, this goes back to the dilemma of, well, to what degree is this real and to what degree is this not real?
Right,
because certainly what's inside our head is real to us,
right.
But it's not real within a sort of objective reality.
Yeah.
And I think I kind of wanted to sort of ask you about how, for example, a stray bit of text leads into this dialectic of real versus unreal,
right.
Subjective versus
objective,
and that kind of, to give you just a huge construct to blame it.
Yeah. Well, I do think that my work has become more actively about just the nature of consciousness as it's gone along and what it means to be, not only what it means to be conscious, but how we separate reality from unreality and, you know, what's real inside our head and what's real outside. And, you know, lately the kinds of things I've been reading philosophically are things like Thomas Metzinger has a book called Being No One and another book called The Ego Tunnel, which have been, I think, pretty critical in terms of just helping me to kind of synthesize some of the ideas that have always been there, but you know, are kind of coming to the fore. So I think on the one hand, there's that. Now, there are, I mean, my texts are really elusive. I mean, I think there are lots of little illusions and mangled illusions and little bits and pieces of things that a lot of people don't see or realize or recognize, but you know, some do. I mean, there's, you know, in Fugue State, there's, you know, there's a story that's pretty directly based on a song, for instance, and there's other sorts of things like that. And I think for me, it's often, you know, there are little bits of language that get stuck in my head or that seem resonant for some reason. And it's partly that, you know, when I don't know that they're necessarily going to appear in the text until they appear in my story. I don't know that they're going to appear until they do actually appear. And I think it's because there's a moment that's become appropriate to them, or there's a moment in which they create a kind of resonance, or there's a moment where I can still have a kind of momentum of the story itself, and that the reader won't get kicked out of the story, but then they'll be able to bring other things in from the outside if they know the reference.
Are there any specific places where you will not go as a writer along these lines?
Not just
in relation to the obvious disturbing levels, but also these philosophical and intertextual levels that you're describing here.
I don't know, honestly. I mean, I think I would like to say no, but I'm sure we could find a place I would not be willing to go to if we thought about it too much. I mean, you know, there are things. I mean, I think that I do have a kind of built-in censor that probably comes partly from childhood and growing up in a certain culture that I both kind of fight against and work alongside of. So there are things that I mean, very often I think there are places I choose not to go, or places that I choose to scale back. I mean, I'm interested in violence in a very particular way. I'm not interested in it when it feels to me like it shades into something that isn't forwarding the story, or that doesn't have a kind of that feels gratuitous. I'm not as interested.
Yeah.
So, but I suppose there may be moments in my writing that don't feel gratuitous to me that would feel gratuitous to some people.
Do you feel that violence is less gratuitous when it's placed in an absurdist context, as it is quite frequently in Last Days, particularly near the end?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, I think that that's a way in which I understand violence, or that I feel like I've figured out strategies of thinking about it, and I also don't feel like I've exhausted, you know, what can be done with violence in an absurd context. So, I think it's partly that. But, you know, there are moments of realistic violence in my work, too.
Well, certainly.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm wondering, in terms of this gratuitous nature, whether somehow the comic spike allows you to revel in it perhaps more so.
I think it might. I mean, I think that the comedy does provide a kind of, you know, the kind of black humor provides a little bit of a release and makes it so that people are willing to kind of take it in a way that they wouldn't if that wasn't there.
Yeah.
But, you know, for me, if with something like Fugue State, the stories that are the most difficult are not the more violent stories. It's the girl stories.
Yeah.
Because I feel like emotionally they're very raw and very very naked. So it's weird. I mean, those seem like those are much harder for me to like read aloud and much harder for the audience to take, to be honest, when I read them aloud than the stories that are more violent.
Well, this also leads me to ask you about a common motif of plunging into a dark chamber, and often there being some shadow of light or whatnot, but very often you have these characters plunging into dark chambers or into rooms or into boxes or whatnot.
Right.
And I'm curious about that because violence happens in the outdoors too, and in the open arena. I mean, you know, and I mean, you know, but also in particular, like in the greenhouse had that shadow of the light that that the character observes. And I'm curious about why always go into the subterranean or into the box or into
that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I think that it may have to do with as a kid I was much more afraid of the dark than I was agoraphobic. That there are kind of, I mean, I think one of the if the work does work, I think one of the reasons it does work is I do draw on fears that feel very real to me, even as they're absurd at the same time. So maybe partly that, but there's something for me about darkness or the basement or these kinds of enclosed spaces that really feels very amenable to my fiction. Occasionally there's stuff that occurs outside, but you're actually right, there's very little. I mean, even in something like Last Days, when it occurs outside, it occurs within the wall, the fence of the compound. So,
but it actually now has me thinking about the many carapaces that house the characters, whether the violence itself or even their feelings or their internal feelings. Do you think that this is a kind of way for you to, I suppose, naturally gravitate towards the psychological, whether it's a car or a wall?
I think it could be that. I mean, I think that they're, you know, in many ways, the spaces we inhabit start to seem like they're parts of us or reflections of us. So I think it could be partly that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It could also be that, you know, when I was 12, I was the dungeon master for all sorts of, and so I like to think of rooms in relation to each other and draw them and things like that.
To what degree do you know the environment before you head into a concept, or is this also something that is spontaneous as well?
It's somewhat spontaneous. It's probably not as spontaneous. I think, like with something like an accounting, I had a pretty good sense of the whole environment as, you know, as I was beginning to write.
Yeah.
And it's something that does seem to spring up pretty readily for me. With other stories, I think it's a little more spontaneous.
Yeah.
You know, something like this title story, Fugue State. You know, I have a lot of stories in which there's several places that characters move back and forth between. And I become very interested in the nature of those places. So there I become very interested in this apartment building and the way in which certain doors have been blocked out, and then how that would be transformed by the characters' perceptions as they're going through as they're going through this kind of fugue state or whatever you want to call it.
Well, it occurs to me that if you have mapped out the locations, you're also attempting to map these emotions, and yet if the map of the location is more definite,
right,
and the map of the perceptions of the emotions is not so definite,
right,
maybe this might be one of the reasons why people are uncomfortable or have simultaneous feelings to your stories.
Yeah, no, I think that may be true. And there are a lot of stories that there's that moments of them occur in darkness where suddenly things have been very precise in terms of the way the hall is set up, and then you can't sort it out. I mean, it's too dark to know what's going on, or moving forward by touch. And that I think is something that was more common with older stories than it is now. It seems to be something I'm moving away from.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
We've touched upon the numbers, or the scale system, in Last Days.
Yeah.
But it's not just related to twos or sevens or eights or tens. It's also related to 20 questions.
Right.
And it made me think naturally of the strange scale of Motorcycle the Human in The Third Policeman by Frank O'Brien.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm curious if this was a possible...
It could have been. I've taught The Third Policeman before, and I really love that book.
Yeah.
I mean, the part of it that blows me away every time is the stuff with the boxes within the boxes, and where you get to tinier and tinier boxes until you're lifting out boxes that can't actually be seen.
Yes.
And
hence my last question.
Yeah, well, I love that. Yeah,
yeah.
For me, that's one of the great moments in literature, this kind of sublime, impossible thing.
Yeah. Sublime and impossible things happen within boxes within boxes?
Well, I just think the gesture of removing things that go beyond perception is something that I really love. That it's the moment when this kind of the sublimity of having something that you can see, and it's getting smaller and smaller, but then entering into a space where you can no longer see it, and I just find that mind-blowing for some reason. Yeah.
You obviously can't see everything that you have ever written, so I'm...
No.
Yeah, or do you... go back to previous stories and try to figure it out, or do you try to get it worked out in the next story, the next book?
Well, I don't know. I mean, sometimes I have gone back and gone back to work that I've put aside for a while. You know, for the novel, The Open Curtain, was something I put aside for a while because I just didn't know what to do with it. But, you know, generally I do try to keep moving forward in some way. So, I mean, I think the thing I'm most interested in now, I've really... Yeah, I grew up very skeptical of genre, despite reading fantasy and science fiction and things like that. And then, at a certain point, I just thought, you know, what's going on here? Why do I think this? And I realized that I had no good reason to think it. And so I've become very interested in the way in which literature and genre fiction can learn from one another. So a lot of my work is kind of moving, I think, in that direction, where I steal from genre writers, and hopefully they steal from me. I think that the way that people think about genre is changing in interesting ways. Sorry, I've gone in another direction.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. That's fine. So really, literature these days is about stealing from as many different writers as possible, putting into a pot in which one can't actually track every little writer, and that therefore you create something unique this way? Is this what it is now?
Well, I think it, you know, there is a kind of postmodern impulse in that, but then there's also, I mean, I think that there's, you know, there's so much that's satisfying in good literature, and there's so much that's satisfying in good genre literature. And, you know, at a certain point I started thinking that there's probably about as much good genre literature as there is good literature. And that... that there is just, you know, the thinking that, you know, I think it's partly that we, with movies, we're absolutely willing to watch, you know, we watch a Disney movie one night and a science fiction movie the next and a thriller the next, and we really don't make, you know, and then a Godard film after that, and we don't necessarily make distinctions between those things. We enjoy them and we can kind of respond to things going on with the style in the film. And I think for some reason we really, you know, for a long time have had these definite boxes between genres, which I don't think is very healthy. I mean, it doesn't reflect my reading anymore. I don't think it ever actually reflected my reading. And it doesn't, I think, reflect the way in which writers are made necessarily.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, hopefully this particular conversation will give some of these listeners food for thought. Ryan, okay. Thanks so much for taking the time.
You.
It was a pleasure.
Oh, pleasure.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you.